Price inflation is the highest it's been in decades. Labor participation is the lowest it's been in decades. Wealth inequality is continually going in the wrong direction since 1971 and has accelerated during the QE period. The bond markets are more volatile now than they have been in decades, and 2022 was the worst year for stocks and bonds since 1920. The ballooning of the money supply and growth of the debt-based monetary system is not a left versus right phenomenon. At least in America, both sides have presided over the destruction of the dollar's purchasing power and the weakening of the banking system. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We have got a great read today. We will be doing part one, mostly just because this is a really lengthy one, and I want to make sure I have time for a guy's take and not turn this into a two-hour show, which it could very easily be if we did this all in one go. And I feel like this first half is a really great primer on the debt situation and the state, really making a sense of the reserve, the idea of the reserves, quote unquote, in the banking system. And one thing I really like about this piece in general is just that it's more Canadian centric than US centric, which is the typical. I basically have read all the pieces that I've read around this have largely been around the United States. And I think it's really important to get a broader view of these things and to understand, you know, you can't just, not everybody's situation is exactly the same. And it's important to understand how they relate to each other. And Brad Mills has a great piece here, which, by the way, I had not realized. I thought I'd read something by Brad on the show before. I don't know. I'm surprised that I hadn't, but I could not seem to find anything. So actually first-time author Brad Mills on the show. So definitely follow him. I will have his Twitter handle and such in the show notes. So there'll be links right down there, right down below in the description of the show. And also, this read is on Bitcoin Magazine, and it is packed full of great charts, data, and links to all of the sources. And I highly, highly recommend it. I will reinforce this again in the short commentary afterward. But seriously, I want you to go and just kind of look through some of these things, maybe while you're listening or afterward, because I think the visual representation and the ability to compare is going to make this information stick a whole lot better. So real quick, before we jump in, I just want to thank our amazing sponsors. Swan Bitcoin is the best onboarding service out there, and they now have a retirement, a IRA that you can set up in literally minutes to get allocated tax-free. And then Fold is going to be the debit card, and not only that, they have gift cards to tons of major merchants. Sats back on everything, literally everything. If you're still using fiat and you're not getting paid sats to do it, you're missing out. And lastly, the Bitcoin that you buy at Swan and that you stack, you earn with Fold. You're going to want it on a cold card. You're going to want it on a secure hardware device. And CoinKite has a plethora of amazing options. And all three of these guys not only make amazing products and services in the space that I use daily, but they help support the show as well. They make this show possible. So a huge thank you to them. And a thank you to you guys for checking them out. It doesn't hurt that you get discounts and free sats and stuff. So click on those links. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled, Is Your Money Safe During the Banking Crisis? By Brad Mills. Big banks are failing, and economic regulators are running out of options. How can you protect your wealth? This is an opinion editorial by Brad Mills, host of the Magic Internet Money podcast, and an investor in several Bitcoin-focused projects. Big banks are failing, Credit Suisse, one of the largest globally systemic important banks, or GSIBs, in the world, at $1.2 trillion in total assets, has recently failed, requiring a bailout from the Swiss Central Bank. Before the era of quantitative easing, or QE, term asset-backed securities loan facility, TARF, and troubled assets relief program, TARP, bailouts, bank failures were common. Allowing excess risk to flush from the system is a healthy part of free markets. Almost 500 banks failed during the Great Financial Crisis. During the last decade of QE, barely any banks failed, while economists, central bankers, and politicians have been continually and confidently assuring us that their stress tests are keeping the banking system sound. Banking failures since 2009. With each year going up by one, so 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012, this is the list of bank failures for each year up to 2021. 140 in 2009, 157 in 2010, 92 in 2011, 51, 24, 18, 8, 5, 8, 0, 4, 4, and 0. Is it a coincidence that during the last decade, as governments, central banks, and commercial banks worked together to expand the money supply faster and higher than ever before in history, that banks stopped failing? Have banks stopped failing over the last 7 to 8 years because banks are safer and more conservative? Or is it because record amounts of money printing and government bailouts have moved the risk from bank balance sheets to somewhere else, simply delaying the inevitable? Did moving this risk from bank balance sheets to the central bank's balance sheets via deficit spending, stimulus, QE, and bailouts actually help keep your deposits safer? Or has it actually caused wealth inequality to rise, debased the value of your savings account, and contributed to high inflation rates, which make the dollars in your bank worth less? Finally, after all of this, are we about to see a reversion to the mean of bank failures anyway? Is there a way to protect yourself from the extremely unlikely event of hyperinflation, or the more likely event of a deflationary bust, or continued high inflation due to governments printing money to prevent the collapse of the global banking system and the loss of confidence in the currency itself? Deposit insurance turned into a confidence game. Economists and policymakers cite Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, and Canada Deposit Insurance Corporation, CDIC, insurance and post-GFC regulations like the Dodd-Frank Act and Basel III stress tests to assuage our concerns, telling us that the banks are healthy and the banking system is sound. The reality is that the insurance fund is woefully undercapitalized to cover large bank failures. In the U.S., there is more than $18 trillion in deposits and only about $125 billion in the FDIC fund. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has more money than the FDIC. FDIC insurance was put in place in 1933 during the Great Depression as a way to provide confidence in the banking system. A lot has changed since 1933. The money supply used to be constrained by the amount of gold that was backing dollars. There was still fractional reserve lending, but it was a lot more conservative back then. While we were on a sound money standard, it was plausible that the FDIC and CDIC could act as a legitimate insurance policy for depositors when coupled with strong bank regulations and balanced budgets. However, the FDIC's reserves have failed to keep up with the growth in the money supply, and it has had to be bailed out in some form or another during the 1990s, in 2008 and 2009, and most recently with the latest round of bank failures. Deposit insurance is just another strategy in the confidence game designed to distract you from discovering the reality of how money and banking work. Addressing fractional reserve banking and the money multiplier. Many think that we operate on a fractional reserve bank system that enables the money multiplier. But this is a common misconception, as banks do not operate on that system anymore. Banks literally have the license to print money from nothing, and the money multiplier is a myth. You may have seen fractional reserve banking and the money multiplier described as the bank keeping 10% of your deposit as reserves and lending the rest out, then repeating that process until the original deposit is multiplied upwards of 10 times. When you deposit $1,000 into the bank, there is no formula that says the bank keeps 10% of that as reserves, and then it can loan out $900 to someone else, repeating this ad nauseum until $1,000 becomes $10,000. In reality, it's fictional reserve banking, because the money lent out by banks is not backed by anything tangible, and the debt that the government issues continually expands. The national debt will never be paid off, and the banks have no reserve requirements anymore. Many smart people reject this framing. They can't accept that this is how the monetary system works. Don't feel bad if you're confused about this stuff. It's an opaque process designed to obfuscate the reality of how the purchasing power of money will always be debased. The modern banking system is like a computer operating system where a small group of people have root-level administrator access, and they give a group of their friends a God-mode cheat code. The reality is that Bank OS has been architected as a system of control and a wealth transfer mechanism from the bottom to the top, and you're probably not at the top. Many smart people who believe they understand the banking system are confused about how banks issue loans. They believe that banks conservatively issue new loans based on the amount of deposits they have. They believe that as customer deposits grow, banks lend that money out. And since the money had to exist in order for the bank to lend it out, the banks didn't print the money. This is a naive understanding, and it does not serve your interest to believe in this fairy tale. Let's take Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, for example, the third largest bank to collapse in U.S. history. To get a picture of what was going on, he has charts here for total loans and leases for Silicon Valley Bank from 1992 to 2022, and then also total deposits at Silicon Valley Bank from 1992 to 2022. The link is in the show notes if you'd like to check out the plethora of charts and data available with this piece. My smart friends will look at the above graphs and say, "See, Silicon Valley Bank didn't just make money from nothing. They received lots of new deposits over the years and loaned out those deposits." They will see that the bank ended with about $200 billion in deposits and about $70 billion in loans, and mistakenly think that the bank was conservatively lending existing money, not creating new money. But the hard-to-accept reality is that the incoming deposits were actually created when a bank made a loan. Maybe it was Silicon Valley Bank that created the deposits from nothing. Maybe it was another bank. But the majority of the deposits in the banking system are created from nothing by banks. My smart friends will say, "Well, this makes no sense. If banks can create money from nothing, why wouldn't they just continually print money to make unlimited profits?" The truth is, when you look at the growth of the money supply, that's what they do. As long as there's demand for borrowing, banks will lend. They have a license to print the money and a license to charge usurious levels of interest on the money. It's a wonder why banks fail at all under a system where they have a license to expand the money supply through issuing loans, constrained primarily by our demand for borrowing and what they deem your creditworthiness to be. Most of the money in the system is actually just created from nothing this way by banks. And as icing on the cake, when you deposit this created from nothing by a bank money into a bank, they also take your deposits and invest them in the treasury market or deposit them to the central bank as bank reserves to make even more profits. The moment that you deposit money into a bank account, it becomes a liability on the bank's balance sheet and is no longer, quote, your money. Bank regulations are part of the confidence game, designed to prevent bank runs by depositors. In March 2020, the reserve requirements for U.S. banks were lifted, and many British Commonwealth countries have been on a zero reserve requirement regulatory scheme for 20 to 30 years. Excerpt, Appendix, The Phasing Out of Chartered Bank Reserve Requirements in Canada. Quote, Reserve requirements were phased out over a two-year period starting June 1992. As of that month, fractional requirements applied to chartered bank deposits were abolished. The dollar amount of requirements was then reduced from the average level of the preceding 12 months by 3% every 6 months until June 1994, when the remaining requirement was entirely removed. End quote. Instead of 8% to 12% reserve requirements, there are various liquidity and collateral rules that banks are urged to follow. One of these rules is the Liquidity Coverage Ratio, or LCR. LCR is important when it comes to bank runs, which is what we are seeing happen now across the global banking system. In order to pass regulatory stress tests, banks must keep a portion of their reserves in high-quality liquid assets, or HQLA, which include cash and cash-like instruments, such as government bonds, that can be quickly sold to meet customer withdrawals. Banks must also have enough high-quality liquid assets in order to meet 30 days of expected net outflows and customer withdrawals. The Bank of Canada assumes that customer deposits in the country's Big Six banks are very sticky, so it only assigns a runoff rate of 3 to 5%. And these banks are not required to keep significant HQLAs to cover deposits. The problem arises when there is a systemic crisis in either the banking system or the money itself that causes fear and panic, driving people to withdraw their money physically or wire it out digitally. In 2022, when Canada Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland invoked the Emergencies Act and threatened to freeze the bank accounts of anyone involved in or supporting the Freedom Convoy, this caused a run on the Canadian banks, as shown by the LCR chart below. This sudden shock and erosion of trust in the Canadian banking system from a large enough percentage of the population caused the LCR of Canada's biggest banks to drop significantly. When a bank run happens, 30 days worth of expected net outflows might be taken out in one day, leaving the bank potentially insolvent if there are liquidity issues with the high-quality liquid assets the bank uses for its HQLA reserves. Too big to fail. How the current bank failures are not like 2008. So now that we know that the money multiplier is a myth and banks are actually allowed to create credit, money, from nothing via fictional reserve banking, authorized by the central bank, let's continue. Why did we not see any signs of bank failures during the last 10 years until now? It turns out that the central bankers kept interest rates near zero while they recapitalized banks and monetized record government debt issuance, deficit spending, to the tune of trillions of dollars. In that environment, banks appear to be healthy. If the government gave you a money printer, I'm sure your finances would be a lot more sound as well. There is a financial soundness indicator that the central banks use, known as Common Equity Tier 1, or CET1 ratio, which is also known as a capital buffer. In the chart below, thanks to QE and other bailout programs, you can see that the soundness of the banks increased until recently when we saw the largest percentage drop of CET1 since they started measuring it. U.S. banks went from having nearly zero excess reserves pre-2008 to being continually injected with hundreds of billions per year via bailouts and QE until the total reserves parked at the Federal Reserve peaked at an astronomical $4 trillion recently. The last banking crisis was caused by too much real estate speculation by the public and too much toxic derivative risk-taking by big banks. The big banks were deemed too big to fail. In order to save the flawed system, they threw out the idea of being fiscally conservative and started normalizing bailouts as the first resort. We are 50 years into the backed-by-nothing U.S. dollar experiment, and nearly 15 years into this infinite reserve banking central planning experiment, and it looks like everything is broken, especially the purchasing power of dollar savers. Too much centralization and interference in financial markets to save the too-big-to-fail banks has shown up as an acceleration of the perversion of incentives in the economy. The role of the dollar went from being a savings vehicle, work hard and save your money, to a system of control and wealth redistribution from the bottom to the top. Work hard and spend your money. Due to this new too-big-to-fail experiment, we've seen the rise of the everything bubble, which makes this crisis much different than the last one. The current crisis is a crisis of confidence in the money itself and the entire banking system, not necessarily anything that the banks did. And here he has a really great chart, actually, that starts from 1970 and goes all the way to 2021, and it shows the change in the financial assets of households and the disposable personal income across the economy, and the spikes and collapses that happened in the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, and then the comparable size of the everything bubble that we are in now. And I think it's a really great visual. So definitely go to that link in the show notes if you want to check that out. How did governments and central banks cause the everything bubble? Interest rates were held artificially low during this period of time, with the central bankers signaling that rates would be held lower for longer. This encouraged overborrowing and excessive risk-taking by banks, corporations, and citizens. Combine this poor central banking policy with gluttonous government deficit spending, and we see the total supply of money rise exponentially. When you add in the supply chain disruptions from the end of the age of abundance, as French President Davos aficionado Emmanuel Macron recently warned about, all of this has caused inflation to rise faster than my generation has seen in our lifetimes. The United States' national debt increased from a staggering $10 trillion to a mind-numbing $30 trillion since the 2008 to 2009 global financial crisis. The money supply has inflated massively. It took the U.S. two centuries to accrue $7 trillion in national debt, until recently when $7 trillion was added in just another 2 years. Price inflation is the highest it's been in decades. Labor participation is the lowest it's been in decades. Wealth inequality is continually going in the wrong direction since 1971 and has accelerated during the QE period. The bond markets are more volatile now than they have been in decades, and 2022 was the worst year for stocks and bonds since 1920. The ballooning of the money supply and growth of the debt-based monetary system is not a left versus right phenomenon, at least in America. Both sides have presided over the destruction of the dollar's purchasing power and the weakening of the banking system. What does history tell us about what might come next? It's very difficult to look at the past and figure out which period of history this is most like. Independent analyst Lynn Alden has pointed out that if you take a very long-term view of the economy and the financial system, the most relevant period of time to compare this to is the 1930s and the 1940s. Since the dollar has lost nearly 97% of its purchasing power over the last 100 years, and the supply of money has changed by orders of magnitudes, she's devised a proxy measuring stick of using percentage of GDP. Aside from 1940s-style inflation, another correlation to that time period is the explosive growth in the debt-to-GDP ratio that we currently face compared to what it was during World War II. Here he has some very eye-opening charts to see a visual comparison between the size of the problem during the 1930s and the Great Depression and World War II, with two different charts, one showing the federal deficit as a percent of GDP comparing to the monetary base as a percent of GDP and the three-month treasury rate, and then another, a century of U.S. debt as a percent of GDP with the non-federal debt as a percent of GDP, and the federal debt as a percent of GDP to compare. Alden points out that, similar to the 1930s, In 2003, interest rates were cut to 1%, which caused banks and citizens to take on lots of debt and risk. Then in 2004 to 2006, the rates were jacked up, which caused the housing crisis that surfaced a few years later, leading to the banking crisis. The can was kicked down the road until 2020 to 2021, when interest rates were cut all the way to zero, while central bankers were printing money and conducting QE. In 2022 to 23, the rates were jacked up, causing the current banking crisis. Alden also points out that in the 1940s as well as in the 1970s, inflation came in waves, and she expects the same to happen over the next decade. In January 2022, during a House of Commons of Canada session, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre gave a speech on the history of money, educating fellow MPs about the follies of money printing and how it causes inflation. "We have not been immune to this inflationary disease. In the post-war era, we inherited monstrous debts fighting the fascists. We basically operated on an American-led standard whereby you could exchange a U.S. greenback at a rate of $35 per ounce in gold." Poilievre continued talking about the prosperity we had in the post-war era under the gold standard. "Here in Canada, with solid currency, we wrestled the inflationary beast to the ground. We paid off our record war debts. We increased the size of the Canadian economy by 300%, and by 1973, we had basically become a debt-free country." "Then what happened in the 1970s? He continued. "President Nixon wanted to spend on warfare and welfare. Of course, the Americans were bogged down in Vietnam, which was costly an enterprise. President Nixon wanted to keep his popularity at home, so he decided to spend. In the decade that followed 1971, not only did they unleash the American dollar from a sound money standard, but they increased the number of U.S. dollars in circulation by 150%, while output only grew by 39%. In other words, the amount of money grew about four times faster than the amount of underlying output that money represented." This next part gets a bit partisan, but it's very relevant to what we're experiencing now. Poilievre continued. "Here in Canada, we had Pierre Elliott Trudeau as Prime Minister. He looked down at all the inflation that the U.S. government was creating. They had reached double-digit inflation, a total inflationary crisis. The American dollar was devalued on an international basis, incapable of buying affordable petroleum on the world market. Poverty was overtaking inner-city streets, and the wealth gap was expanding in the United States of America. What did Pierre Elliott Trudeau do? He started printing money here in Canada, massively increasing the money supply. Between 1971 and 1981, the money supply in Canada grew by over 200%, while GDP only grew in real terms by about 47%. So you can imagine, when money is growing in supply at more than four times the rate as the economy is growing, you have more dollars chasing fewer goods. And what do you get? Inflation. Why deflation is good, and prices should come down, if it weren't for central banks and politicians. Not only are we dealing with government-induced inflation, but we're also now suffering from their proposed solution to inflation, jacking up the interest rates and crushing everyone financially. The banking crisis was never fully dealt with in 2008 and 2009. Instead of taking a decade of pain allowing rates to naturally rise while overleveraged large banks failed and poorly run businesses went under, they decided to socialize the losses and privatize the gains. Not only was the can kicked down the road, but central bankers and economists tried to sell us on being scared of deflation. They were trying to nationalize their monetary machinations as a way to stop prices from dropping, trying to fearmonger and convince all of us that lower prices is a bad thing. In Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow, he describes how technology is deflationary. If we had a sound money like Poilievre described, it would make sense that technological advancements and productivity gains would cause prices to drop. With a more sound money that does not continually inflate like our current debt-based broken money system, your purchasing power would not decline over time, and we would enjoy the deflationary benefits of technology. With deflation and a more sound monetary system, you could live a dignified life and afford a home on a smaller wage as prices naturally come down. Critics of sound money will say that under the gold standard we saw booms and busts, and you can't get out of an economic depression without inflating the money supply. There is no easy answer here, and the solution is probably something in the middle, at least during a transitory phase. We need to slowly transition to a sound money system while also increasing financial literacy. Critics of sound money systems like a gold-backed standard too often rely on a false dichotomy argument, where it has to be either continuous stimulus or global depression with nothing in the middle. Something has to change. It's clear that the debt-based, money-printing, stimulus-by-default system we've been operating on has seen continual expansion of the wealth gap. In fact, it is plausible to have a period of transition where you could help the bottom 50% out with a form of universal basic income, while you increase financial literacy and encourage saving in a hard money. You could do this while eliminating a lot of excessive federal spending and transitioning to a more sound monetary system over a period of 5 to 15 years, all while we enjoy the benefits of technology making our lives better. Politicians, mainstream economists, and central bankers are fighting the deflationary benefits of technology by arbitrarily targeting 2% inflation and continually increasing the supply of money via various methods like government deficit spending, commercial bank credit creation, and central bank money printing. Since these economists and bankers were claiming that QE and stimulus didn't cause inflation, they were fear-mongering about a deflationary spiral, trying to create the political will for the next round of money printing to keep their inflation experiment going. And predictably, they overreacted and gave us an inflationary crisis instead of a deflationary one. Governments cause inflation and inflate asset bubbles with QE. Canada's central bankers followed the consensus of the rest of the G20 countries, especially the US. Like most G20 countries, the Canadian government cannot finance deficit spending without issuing debt, since there was not sufficient demand to purchase the newly issued debt or bonds. Trudeau and Freeland worked in lockstep with Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem, essentially directing the Bank of Canada to buy long-term debt from the government via the banks to artificially manipulate the rates as close to zero as they could get it. They call this QE. Shockingly, beginning in 2019, the Bank of Canada has purchased an abnormally high percentage of all Canadian government bonds issued, which has enabled the Trudeau government to ignore free market impulses and put the country into historic debt levels. Canada's public and private debt to GDP expanded much faster than any other G20 country at the start of 2020. The chart here you really just have to see, and I will the same link in the show notes, but definitely check this out. This is the change in the debt to GDP ratio of all of the G20 countries, and the stark contrast, the huge gap that Canada has with the rest of them. You really just should see it just for the visual scope of what happened. All right, let's jump back in. That trend continued until just recently, when our total debt to GDP began to look more like the peak of the US's debt to GDP ratio in the 1940s, during World War II. Remember, this includes public debt, federal and provincial government deficit spending and liabilities, and private debt, corporate and household debt. From Canadian macroeconomic forecaster Joseph Barbudo, aka Economic Longwave, here is what Canada's historical debt to GDP looks like over the last century. We have to go back to the 1930s to see the last time our public debt to GDP ratio was this high. Part of the reasoning behind this massive deficit spending was that Freeland and Macklem were both blindsided by inflation, along with all of their G8 money master peers, fear-mongering about deflation as recently as October 2020. In August of 2022, after the price of homes, investments, and other desirable items had caught up to all of the newly issued money, and inflation soared to the highest it's been in decades, Freeland, Macklem, and the Bank of Canada were trying to control the narrative around inflation, they released a statement claiming that they did not cause inflation by, quote, printing money, and shifted the blame using the everybody else is doing it defense, while advising businesses not to increase wages in response to rising prices. Jesse Berger, a Canadian author focused on monetary policy, commented, "Earlier this month, the Bank of Canada blamed you for inflation and told you not to give raises despite awarding themselves $45 million in bonuses." He continued, "Where did they get the funds to buy bonds? They didn't print cash per se, they just used a kind of central bank reserve thing. No physical notes means it's not literally printed cash, so it's a figurative lie, not a technical one." This is how they try to confuse what they are doing with complicated terms like quantitative easing and obfuscate what money is by labeling the money they create during QE as central bank reserves. However, in November of 2022, Macklem testified that the Bank of Canada should have started tightening rates sooner, and government spending contributed to inflation. What is QE? Quantitative easing demystified. Poilievre spoke at a rally about the effects of quantitative easing on the money supply, inflation, and interest rates in Canada. Cogently explaining how the central bank pays to buy the bonds from the government, he said, "Well, it deposits money in the financial institutions' accounts held at the Bank of Canada. The deposits for these financial institutions skyrocketed to about $300 billion from almost nothing within a couple of years." He continued, "Those deposits can be turned into hard paper cash. That is why the money supply went from $1.8 trillion to $2.3 trillion, half a trillion dollars, which is almost exactly what the deficit was. Not a coincidence. The paper money, the stuff that's printed, went from $90 billion to $124 billion. Both increased by approximately 27% in a few years. The money that's still on deposit with the central bank has created a new problem. The central bank bought bonds with yields of 0.25% and paid for it with deposits on which it now has to pay 4.5%. In other words, they're now losing money on the spread. For the first time in history, the Central Bank of Canada needs a bailout of $4 billion a year. That doesn't take into consideration any additional losses that will happen if they eventually sell those bonds, which are now worth less than when they bought them. This has been very good for the very wealthy, because in addition to arbitraging those transactions, this inflationary policy drove up asset prices." Poilievre continued, "If you have a $10 million mansion and house prices go up by 50%, you've just made $5 million tax-free. If you're the new immigrant who doesn't own any property, the purchasing power of your dollar in terms of real estate has just gone dramatically down." Poilievre punctuated his lesson on how QE creates wealth inequality by saying it is a, quote, "massive wealth transfer from the have-nots to the have-yachts." Quick review so far. At this point, I'd like to recap and add some more factors to the discussion so that we can continue understanding why many banks are technically insolvent and starting to fail. 1. Central bankers held interest rates too low and signaled to everyone, including the banks, that they will continue to keep rates low to avoid deflation, promoting the flawed logic of inflation is transitory and deflation is bad. 2. Banks do not operate on a reserve system anymore. Instead, they continually create debt money through credit issuance and are encouraged to hold high-quality liquid assets such as government bonds and mortgage-backed securities to protect against bank runs in case everyone discovers there are not adequate reserves for everyone to get their money out. 3. Governments inflated the money supply with massive stimulus and deficit spending. Central banks enabled the massive deficit spending with QE. 4. QE by itself did not directly add new money to the system, even though the central bank created the reserves from nothing, because banks used existing money, our deposits, to buy the bonds which they sold to the central banks. 5. The G7 made a difficult decision to drop a nuclear bomb on the financial system by sanctioning Russia, putting contagion pressure on European and other Western banks. And 6. Central banks started raising rates faster than they ever have before in history to combat inflation, deflating the bond bubble and causing banks to become insolvent. All right. I actually want to pause right here, and we will stop this with part one because we are halfway through, and I think hitting these 6 points for reviewing the first half will actually be a great way to start off part two in tomorrow's episode. If you have a traditional IRA, a traditional retirement, and you're not allocated to Bitcoin, are you considering the risk that that might entail? If you haven't, go to swanbitcoin.com and check out, well, slash guy, actually, and check out their retirement options. You can set up a traditional or Roth IRA in minutes and allocate to Bitcoin held in a trust in your name. When it comes to traditional market instruments, this is about as good as it gets outside of just putting it in cold storage and holding the keys yourself. The benefit here would be that it is tax-free. So if you haven't explored that option and you have a traditional IRA or retirement, you definitely need to. Or of course, you could go the route I just kind of cashed everything out. I paid fees. I did all that stuff because I'm a cold storage kind of guy and I bought it on Swan. Obviously, Swan is where I've gotten my Bitcoin for ages. I love the automatic savings plan so that I can just buy every single week and not think about it. But the automatic withdrawals were really one of the big things that I don't manage anything. It literally is just running all the time. And then I just break out the Swan app and, you know, smash buy whenever there's a great opportunity or there's a really big red candle sometime. I get a good opportunity. It's like, boom, let me just put a few thousand dollars in this. I'm just stacking Bitcoin as hard as I can go. Swan Bitcoin just has so many amazing resources, and the Swan Private group, the Swan Private, the newsletter that they have, the analysis, the regular events and advisory meetings, like they were a huge help in tax loss harvesting last year. Seriously, if you want excellent Bitcoin advice, an easy and high signal onboarding service, and just an amazing team that's always accessible, you just need to check out Swan Bitcoin. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. That'll also help out the show. All right, let's jump back in. So there's a number of things that I want to get into in the guy's take, which I think will mostly follow part two. But I just thought this was a really great rundown in pulling together what, you know, another big picture overview of what's going on in the world right now. And I think it's forever important to keep kind of going through the fundamentals and reassessing the data and the major pieces of the puzzle here as things continue to move forward. Because I feel like every time I read one of these, there's some new little piece of information that I wasn't quite aware of. And it's also, this is a great, great way to kind of dig through sources for this. And I know I've mentioned it in talking about the charts and stuff, but I highly, highly recommend going to the link, looking at the article on Bitcoin Magazine, and going through the charts to get a feel, to get a visual overview of what is happening. Because there's something just about the visual comparison of a lot of these things that really just kind of drives home the point really well. And a shout out to Brad Mills for writing this one. This is a really long and really in-depth piece that just hits so many of the major points of what's going on. And he gets more specifically into what this means for Bitcoin and what this means for deposits. And, you know, the difference in between the risks of is your money safe in a nominal sense? Are you going to be able to get your currency? And then comparing that to the sense or conditions of, is your currency going to be able to buy anything? Are you safe in the existence of the currency or the existence of the currency's purchasing power, and kind of the different dynamics involved because of how, you know, and I think largely it makes sense that the quote unquote deposits, the access to the nominal currency is going to be what the government does everything in their power to make not a problem to make it, because that's the visibility to the individual person, right? As long as it can appear as if your deposits are there, well, it's a whole lot easier to blame someone else for the inflation when nobody knows what's going on, nobody understands the dynamics because they haven't read Brad Mills' article here. They haven't listened to Bitcoin Audible for, you know, 1,000+ episodes. The average person is going into this blind and largely hearing what the news is telling them. Luckily, a lot more people are actually escaping that bubble and becoming more and more aware of what's happening. And as the trust breaks down in our political institutions and as the trust breaks down in the media establishment, which has been happening in full force for a number of years now, COVID really, the 2020 insanity really did a, for better or for worse, the disaster that it was did wake up so many people to the insanity, the tyranny, and the sheer incompetence of our government systems and the narcissism of the politicians who literally believe that they can top down engineer society to be this perfect world as long as they have as much power as they can possibly obtain and zero restraint whatsoever in executing or exercising that power in any way that they have. I mean, the offhanded, just brazen dismissal of any possible consequences or considering that what they're doing could be bad or that someone shouldn't have the power to do that is just mind-blowing. And unfortunately, this has infected the brain of the normie person. Like, we've just been so conditioned to believe authority, to just do whatever we are told. And I think this is a combination of many, many different factors over a very, very long span of time to create an insanely dependent and subservient population who absolve themselves of any responsibility of determining reality or making choices for themselves and able to politically push it onto anyone else, right? The responsibility of my gender is someone else. The responsibility of my income is somebody else. The responsibility of making my life worthwhile. It, like, the reason all I have problems is because somebody has persecuted me. I'm the victim of X, Y, Z, and all the rest. And these things compound on themselves generation by generation because you create some sort of entitlement and then everybody's just like, it's absurd. The idea of getting rid of it is just chaos. It's just, how could you possibly give this to one person and not give it to me? And then that becomes the new norm. A simple example is the Department of Education. If the state of education, the cost of education, and the results of education, if all of these things are the report card of the Department of Education, they have failed across the board. I mean, nothing but straight Fs. And the Department of Education was created in like the late 70s, I think it was. Or maybe it was very early 80s, somewhere right around that zone. While their budget for the last decade or so, ever increasing, obviously, has been in like the $50 to $100 billion range. Now, if you even entertain, if you talk about the idea of getting rid of the Department of Education, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy. You can't, you're laughed at, like that's just utter insanity. You're talking about the death of education. Now the Department of Education is equated to the concept of education at large in the minds of all the people who grew up in this world where the Department of Education was just static. It was just a part of the world, right? Yet what we're really talking about is just going back to prior, like, was education non-existent in 1975? Was everybody stupid? Was everybody an illiterate boob? Like, we're all just cavemen running around, banging our heads on things and grunting like monkeys? Of course not. Yet the only possible solution is to give more money to the Department of Education. The literal institution that has nothing but qualitatively destructive results on the very thing it was supposedly created to benefit, all while also soaking up about $100 billion worth of precious, scarce resources that other people need to destroy our education, to make education worse, to make it more politicized, to make it more top-down and quote-unquote standardized, which just means that It gets broadly dumbed down and loses all of its qualitative value in order to get the nominal results that it's seeking to achieve. I'm sorry, but if somebody charges me $1,000 a year for a service that's supposed to solve the problem of, you know, small things going wrong on the car, and that they're going to do normal maintenance, and they're going to get all the professionals together, and they're going to make sure that my car is always running in tip-top shape, and then I have twice as many tiny things go wrong or little things to replace on the car during that year, and I still have to pay for all of those mistakes, and the condition of my car is that much worse, I'm going to stop paying for that service because it's a shitty service. The problem when you put these into political institutions is that you can't do that. Like, it's not possible to, it's simply not feasible to undo something that gives political power, especially when you have the power to print money in order to achieve that. And that's just a microcosm of the entire space. Of the whole, of the apparatus and the mindset, the fiat brain that goes into these top-down structures. And it's funny, too, like Brad Mills, I don't even agree with everything in this article. I just think it's a really great broad breakdown of the situation, especially from a Canadian point of view, which is something that I don't really get to explore a whole lot. And I know I have a lot of listeners in Canada, so I really appreciate having a kind of a different rundown. Everything that I typically read is very US-centric. But I've got a lot of notes here that I want to get into in the second part of this read, or in the guy's take after that. But I don't want to take too much longer here, just because we are going to be covering all of this. And I'll talk about where I think he has some really great things in explaining where deposits are created and all of this stuff. In fact, one of the things that I just really like the way he frames it, and it's so funny, like I just kind of lose it when I'm in the Bitcoin space because everybody is so much more knowledgeable about the basic workings of the banking system and the money system. But it's just crazy to me that people still don't really, like, it's just not known. It's not known. And how could you possibly have a proper opinion or a reasonable opinion or course of action to take when you do not know, when the average person does not know that loans are created out of thin air, that quote unquote bank deposits have no reserves, that money is literally issued into existence as debt, and there are no reserve requirements left. In fact, it was always a facade, and I loved his term. I don't know if he got this from somewhere else, but the fictional reserve system, that is great. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that like counterfeit class. Those are the proper terms, right? It's the counterfeit class, not the elite. And it's not the fractional reserve system, it's the fictional reserve system. So in fact, if people hear me improperly refer to those things in the show, I'll pay you 1,000 sats. I want to make sure that I am using, you call things by their proper name. It's the fictional reserve system and it's the counterfeit class. Hold me to that, guys. All right, we will close this one out. Thank you for listening to part one of Is Your Money Safe During the Banking Crisis? And we will get into part two in the next episode, so do not forget to subscribe. Do not forget to follow Brad Mills, and I give him a shout out, throw him a tip. I think he's on Noster, if I'm not mistaken. I'll make sure one way or the other and get his pub key if he is. And stay tuned because the second half of this is really great, as was the first half. But he really kind of brings it home and hits really well kind of Bitcoin's position in this and what the major... And I think he's largely right outside of what we'll talk about in the guy's take. But the major risks here and the things that aren't quite the risk just because of the natural... reinforced centralization of a horribly centralized system. You know, it's the nature of the movement toward total political control by a system that's actually political at its base. Like, it's all the money itself is an authority-based system. It's just inevitably fully centralized, essentially. And what that actually means for your deposits, outside of, you know, both in the context of their value and whether you can access them, but also kind of in the context of, you know, what he brought up with the Freedom Convoy and whether or not politics wants you to access them. What happens when they have granular control over everything that you do, and whether or not we want to be in that world. So Anyway, we'll go over a lot of this and talk about it in the guy's take as well as in the second part of this excellent piece. So stay tuned, stay subscribed. Don't forget to check out Swan Bitcoin, Fold, and CoinKite. CoinKite is going to give you the best hardware wallet and security options for keeping your Bitcoin secure. Fold is how you're going to get away from your nasty, dirty debit bank and debit card and normal bank. And you're going to get a debit card that pays you sats, because that's the only way to do fiat, get paid sats to do it. And then Swan Bitcoin, where you're going to onboard into Bitcoin and you're going to have the best, purest signal. And you get your business, your IRA. Somebody actually thanked me just the other day. They got their retirement all over into Swan Bitcoin, and they're stoked that it's allocated to Bitcoin. And that's awesome. That's awesome to hear. So thank you, guys. And with that, I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, guys, take it easy. When the whole world is running towards a cliff, he who is running in the opposite direction appears to have lost his mind. C.S. Lewis.